When you look at American political history, Richard Nixon stands out, doesn't he? Maybe the most complex, perhaps even the most tragic figure.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, here's a man who achieved these incredible geopolitical wins. You think China, détente, huge things.
Right, world-changing
But
stuff.
then he's forever stuck with, well, Watergate, a wound he basically inflicted on himself.
It's the ultimate contradiction, isn't it? Just staggering political skill right alongside this equally staggering capacity for, I don't know, paranoia, self-sabotage.
Exactly that, paranoia and self-destruction.
So today, we're not just going to list, the good and the bad. We're doing a deep dive using Eben Thomas's book, Being Nixon, A Man Divided, because we really want to get inside that paradox.
Yeah, the book's focus is great for that.
What was it actually like to be Richard Nixon? How did that internal struggle, that division, end up shaping history?
That's the key question, isn't it? To understand the big moments, we first have to grasp the deep-seated insecurity, but also that relentless ambition. They fuel both the triumphs and the tragedy.
Okay, so if we want to understand the man, we have to go back. Back to the beginning, his upbringing in Yorba Linda, California. Kind of a hardscrabble start.
Oh yeah, definitely not easy street. And Thomas argues this taught him life was a constant fight, that he was always sort of the outsider looking in. You see the split right there in his parents.
How so?
Well, he had his mother, Hannah, deeply religious Quaker, very disciplined, serious, a moral anchor, maybe.
Okay.
But then his father, Frank, he was described as volatile, argumentative, often failing in business. So Nixon kind of absorbed both things, the moral seriousness from his mother and this combative resentment from his father.
And the book puts a lot of weight on those early losses he suffered. Two brothers.
Yes, Arthur and Harold both died from tuberculosis. Thomas suggests this was just profoundly shaping. It left Nixon with this sense of fatalism, like life's just fundamentally unfair.
Wow.
But also this almost fierce determination. He felt he had to succeed, not just for himself, but for the whole family. Like he was carrying all their hopes. That's a huge weight for a kid.
You can see how that shapes a worldview. This idea that life requires constant grinding effort. And this gets reinforced later, right? When he tries to break into the elite world. He goes to Whittier, then Duke Law.
Duke Law School. That's where he got that nickname, Iron Butt.
Tells you everything, doesn't it?
It really does. Pure hard work, sheer willpower, not connections, not charm, just grinding it out.
And even then, graduating third in his class, he still faces this major rejection.
That's the kicker. The big New York law firms, they wouldn't hire him. Shut out.
And Thomas argues that specific rejection just burned itself into him.
Absolutely. It became the fuel for this lifelong, really intense resentment of what he saw as the Eastern establishment. The irony is just dripping, isn't it?
What do you mean?
He spends his whole life battling this establishment, but also desperately craving its respect. That rejection convinced him the game was rigged, you know, that the usual paths were closed to him. Politics became the arena where he could fight back and win.
Okay, that really sets the stage for his political approach, this idea of the divided man, the outsider. So how did he structure his political world based on that feeling of being scorned?
He saw it as a battlefield, always. It was fundamentally us versus them.
Who was us and who was them?
Us was, you know, the hardworking, decent, ordinary Americans, what he later called the silent majority, them. Well, that was everybody else he felt looked down on him, the liberal media, the academics, the cool Eastern elites, definitely the Kennedys. This kind of siege mentality, it wasn't just a feeling, it was his core political strategy.
What's so fascinating and sort of tragic is how his biggest strengths seem directly connected to this core insecurity.
Completely intertwined, that Iron Butt thing, that sheer tenacity and determination, that's what let him pull off these unbelievable political
Like
comebacks.
after 62, when everyone wrote him off.
Exactly. Losing the California governor's race like that should have been the end. But he claws his way back to win the presidency in 68. That takes incredible grit.
Okay, but then how does that same strength, that same refusal to quit, become his fatal flaw during Watergate?
Because the fighter in him couldn't see it any other way. When the Watergate investigation started heating up, he didn't see it as, you know, a legal problem or an ethical crisis he needed to manage by, say, cutting his losses.
No.
No, he saw it as just another attack from them, the media, his political enemies, the establishment trying to take him down. So his instinct, that deeply ingrained fighter instinct, was to counterattack, to cover up, to stonewall, to win at all costs.
His determination became self-destructive.
Utterly. It was the paranoia and the combativeness overriding everything else.
And there's that image Thomas uses, which really captures this inability to ever truly be at ease. Mm-hmm. Nixon on the beach.
Oh, yeah. That's such a powerful visual metaphor. He's walking on the sand right by the ocean.
That he's wearing what?
A full suit. Dark suit, dress shoes, the works. It's like he was physically incapable of taking off the armor. He couldn't relax, couldn't be casual. He was always on, always the statesman, always sort of braced for a fight, even against the waves, apparently.
Wow. Okay, let's shift to some of those key political moments that really built the Nixon persona we remember. The good, the bad, and, well, the ruthless. The Alger Hiss case back in 48. What did that teach him?
Hiss was basically the template. By going after Alger Hiss, this former State Department guy, accusing him of being a spy, Nixon became a huge hero to conservatives overnight.
Right, made his name nationally.
Totally. And it taught him that being aggressive, playing on fears like communism, and really hammering the perceived weaknesses of the liberal establishment, that stuff worked. It was politically potent. Brutal, maybe, but effective. It's also where he got the tricky dick label.
Okay, so that shows the ruthless operator. But then just a few years later, 1952, the Checker speech. He shows a totally different skill set.
Pure political theater, and frankly, genius for its time. He's accused of taking improper campaign funds. His spot on the VP ticket is in danger.
Mm-hmm.
And what does he do? He goes on this new medium, television, bypasses all the party bosses and the reporters, and talks directly to the American people.
And talks about the dog.
And talks about the dog, Checkers. This sentimental, almost folksy performance, It completely saved him. It showed he could connect with ordinary people over the heads of the elites he despised, and improved his mastery of TV.
But TV and the elites kind of got their revenge in 1960, didn't they? Those debates with Kennedy.
Oh, that 1960 loss was crushing for him. Psychologically huge. On camera, he looked awful, sweaty, shifty, uncomfortable, especially next to Kennedy, who was just radiating charisma and confidence.
Looked terrible.
Yeah. And for Nixon, this just confirmed everything he already believed, that the media was biased, the system valued superficial style and Ivy League polish over substance and hard graft. He took that loss very, very personally. It dipped in the bitterness.
Mm. And yet, despite all that resentment, all that tricky dick baggage, he somehow achieves this moment of genuine statesmanship. The opening to China, 1971, 72.
Yeah, this is the flip side, isn't it? This is the good Nixon, the strategist. And it took him, the lifelong, diehard anti-communist, to do it.
Why him specifically?
Because anyone else, any Democrat or moderate Republican, would likely have been destroyed politically for trying to make peace with Mao Zedong's China. Only Nixon had the anti-communist credentials to pull it off. It was brilliant realpolitik aimed at completely reshaping the Cold War map.
And this was the legacy he wanted, right?
Not desperately. This proved he wasn't just a scrappy political fighter. He was a world historical figure, a grand strategist operating on a global stage. This was supposed to be his vindication.
So if he reached that pinnacle, that validation, why did it all still come crashing down with Watergate? If China was the peak, why the fall?
Well, according to Thomas's analysis, Watergate wasn't really an aberration. It wasn't a mistake made under pressure. It was more like the logical conclusion of his character.
I saw.
The paranoia, the you versus them mentality, it never went away. Even after the 72 landslide, he believed his enemies, the press, the Democrats, the establishment, were out to get him, to undermine his mandate.
So he felt justified in fighting back.
Completely justified. He'd already established patterns of using government power, the FBI, the IRS, for political harassment against opponents. The Watergate break-in and the subsequent cover-up were just extensions of that mindset. It was rooted in his deepest fears and resentments.
Which leads to that really chilling defense he offered years later.
Oh, yeah. That infamous line. When the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
Just sends a shiver down your spine.
It does. Because it reveals this almost imperial view of the presidency. He genuinely seemed to believe that his actions, if done in what he perceived as the national interest, which often blurred with his own political survival, were somehow above the law itself. He couldn't separate himself from the office or admit wrongdoing because in his mind, he was defending the nation against them.
And the cost of that belief when the cover-up finally unraveled was just utter isolation, wasn't it? There's that image from his final days.
Yeah, it's incredibly poignant. Thomas recounts Nixon wandering the halls of the White House at night, obviously distraught, maybe drinking heavily.
Talking to the portraits.
Talking to the portraits of the former presidents, especially Lincoln, apparently. Seeking guidance, or maybe just company. It just captures this profound loneliness, the immense historical weight finally crushing him, and the very place he fought his entire life to reach and hold on to.
Just gut-wrenching. But even then, even after the resignation, that old Nixon resilience kicks in one last time.
It's remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah.
The iron butt resurfaces. He doesn't just disappear. He embarks on this slow, methodical comeback.
How?
Writing books, serious books on foreign policy, offering advice to his successors, gradually, painstakingly, transforming himself into a kind of elder statesman figure. He was still fighting, you see, fighting for his place in history, trying to reshape the narrative away from solely Watergate, mm-hmm. right up to the end.
So, wrapping this up, we come back to that central contradiction, his legacy. You have these huge foreign policy wins, China, détente, real achievements.
Undeniable achievements. And even significant domestic policy, like creating the EPA, OSHA, pushing desegregation. Things people often forget.
Right. But it's always seen through the Watergate lens, that shadow looms over everything.
It does. It's a legacy perpetually at war with itself. The strategic brilliance forever tainted by the character flaws that led to the abuse of power and the profound erosion of public trust.
And the core lesson from this deep dive into being Nixon.
I think it's about the corrosive nature of resentment. Holding onto those grievances, that sense of being slighted. It didn't empower him in the end. It poisoned him. It magnified his insecurities and ultimately undid his own accomplishments. Power didn't cure the insecurity. It just gave it bigger weapons.
And connecting it to our world now, Thomas kind of suggests that Nixon's methods didn't just fade away with his presidency.
No, not at all. The book makes a pretty strong case that Nixon essentially wrote the playbook for a certain kind of modern politics.
How so?
That direct appeal to the silent majority, mm-hmm. deliberately stoking resentment against perceived cultural elites, framing politics as this existential struggle between us and them.
Yeah.
That also feels very familiar, doesn't it?
It really does, which leaves a final thought, maybe for you, the listener, to chew on.
Yeah, if Nixon's divided soul really did pioneer this permanent campaign of grievance politics, how much of the intense polarization, the culture wars, the sort of us versus them dynamic we see everywhere today, how much of that is still running on the blueprint Richard Nixon laid down all those years ago?